We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello and welcome to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Mark. I am on with my co-host Kim. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for having me.
it's been a very turbulent week of technical errors, but we've jumped through the hoops and we are here at the end of the tunnel, and all of that nonsense is behind us, thank goodness.
Yes, we are here. We have scratched and clawed our way to bring you season one, episode 23 of Unsolved Mysteries.
Now, this one is about as old as you are. It's from the late 80s, April 26, 1989. Mm-hmm. I think I was like in 11th grade or something.
Yeah, and I was like 3 months old.
Yeah. I was just kind of healing from my April Fool's joke that somebody pranked me with. maybe, I don't know. But yeah, this is a whirlwind of an episode. We were saying this is a pretty dark episode. I think you pointed out there's not one story here that does not involve some form of death one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So getting into the first story, which takes place in California, San Jose. I think that's Southern California. Is that Southern?
It's more like Bay Area, if memory serves correctly.
It's a pretty good area now, actually. It's like Silicon Valley. I don't believe it was as up and coming at the time, but now I think that the properties are untouchable.
And even though this is an Unsolved Mysteries from 1989, this crime is actually from 1978, so even less so.
Yeah. This one is about the motorcycle mom, and I have to say that the mom who's involved in the story is so much more of the story than the actual story itself.
Mm-hmm. 100%, as she should be. Honestly, I think that this is the best mom we've ever talked about.
According to the story, the story is about Gus Hoffman, and he's a popular guy. I don't know about that. You know, I don't know what that means. I mean, the guy worked in his shop building computer. He used to etch the microchip, the things that microchips would go on, like the silicon things. Yeah, I looked into it a little bit. His father had a small business. They worked kind of out of their garage, practically. And they he would mill the PCBs with that everything gets put on. And at the time, of course, it's where Silicon Valley, you know, it's called Silicon Valley because it's kind of the birth of where Microsoft came out of, where Apple came out of. I'm really kind of interested as to who they were working with. I couldn't find very much information about that.
This I don't know much about, but I do know that 20-year-old Gus does more stuff in his garage. He likes to restore old motorcycles.
Yeah, so he acquired a 1966 Harley-Davidson Sportster, which I think is a pretty collectible bike, actually, nowadays.
It's cute.
You know, I like this style of motorcycle. It's a little smaller. To me, this is like a cool retro-looking motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it's only 11 years old. And he'd spent a lot of money restoring it, which is kind of weird.
He spent 8 months and $4,000 bringing it up to like mint condition.
Yeah, and you know, you can go and find a bike like this. You could spend as much as you want on anything, but you could find one of these in pretty good condition for about $6,000.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of weird. Well, even that, it was never considered this like an Indian motorcycle. It's never been considered a really high price bike, but at the same time, $6,000 is nothing to sneeze at. It's a lot of money still.
Yeah,
especially for basically a bicycle with a motor on it. So his parents were really angry about this. They didn't, I think like most parents, they're not too comfortable with motorcycles. So they gave him the ultimatum. Either you go or the bike goes. right?
She says that she was like, Rose, the mom, is like, yeah, you go where the bike goes because we are so worried something's going to happen to you because of that bike. So on the 4th of July, 1978, he actually puts the finishing touches on it and decides to just kind of take it out on a short ride, test it out, maybe show it off a little bit. And they never saw him again.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's kind of weird. I mean, it's July 4th, and maybe it's the first time he's riding it. That doesn't make too much sense. He has to know how to ride a motorcycle in order to ride a motorcycle.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. He wanted to, like, kind of show it off, I think, maybe a little bit.
So, do you guys ride motorcycles? Just
Jack
curious.
Had a motorcycle before we got together and then sold it. So I have ridden on motorcycles before, but I'm not like a motorcycle rider.
Now, are you opposed to Jack getting a motorcycle? He's asking me.
No. No, the only thing is in Florida, it's voluntary if you want to wear a helmet or not. So I would ask that he wear a helmet. But, you know, I'm not his mom. If he wants to get a motorcycle, go for it.
No, just some people just have a different kind of opinion. They might have seen a really bad car accident or something like that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
When I was young, I used to ride dirt bikes and everything. But I'm not really into motorcycles. But I'll stick to four wheels.
And there are some shady motorcycle riders in this story.
We get into the world of gang, like motorcycle gangs or clubs, whatever people call them these days.
They call them clubs, but this was a gang, and it is a now defunct gang called the Forgotten Few. But I just want to say real quick, his mom tried to call the police because he's young, you know, apparently they talk to each other every single day, and the police said, you know, you can't do anything until 48 hours have passed. So Rose is like, I don't need no stinking police. I'm going to go look for him on my own.
Yeah, I mean, I have a feeling that Rose maybe rode a motorcycle when she was younger. She's pretty badass.
She is. Oh, like, my God. She's tough. Amazing.
And we'll get to why we were saying that she's tough and tough and tough. But the show says that he was 19, but you found out that he's actually 20, which is just another one of these kind of weird unsolved mystery technicalities. But
I've never run into more mistakes when researching than on this episode. It was like, really? Good Lord, they must have just rushed this one because everywhere else said that he was 20. But she begins like canvassing the neighborhood and she runs into one of Gus's friends who works at a gas station. And the friend says that on the 4th of July, he saw Gus pull up on a motorcycle with like two other guys on choppers behind him.
Yeah.
And then behind the three of them, there seemed to be a blue Monte Carlo following them very closely. So Gus's friend was like, I recognize those two guys on the chopper because they were like so rude to me. They've come into the gas station before. They were mean, long-haired, tough guys.
So we're getting that whole like kind of vibe of like, you know, a gang, maybe even in this area. I don't know what kind of gangs exist, but if it is kind of like Southern California, you know, there are a lot of like kind of Latin gangs. There's a lot of, at the time, maybe a lot of Hell's Angels. Not really sure.
Yeah, this one, they were called the Forgotten Few. But one of the guys who we'll get into claimed he was a Hell's Angels. And the Hell's Angels were like, no way, this guy is too crazy for us. Like, we don't want this guy. So a second witness says that the two guys stopped Gus, argued him for a second, and then threatened him with chains.
Yeah, that seems like to be one of those things. Like, you find that a lot in gangs, like motorcycle gangs. They always seem to have access to big chains.
Only frame of reference for anything motorcycle, especially motorcycle and chains, is the Sega Genesis game Road Rash.
Yeah. You know, for whatever reason, I thought it was something else when you wrote that. And then I thought of Sons of Anarchy, which I used to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me feel tough. But, you know, but you're right. You took a screenshot of the guy with the chain and it's one of those kind of things that probably, I mean, if they're getting to this conclusion, it's probably something that happens from time to time. You know, people get beat with chains.
Yeah, probably. So horrible. But Gus, our little Gus, 20-year-old, drives off and the guys chase him and the blue Monte Carlo followed. So the two witnesses ID one of the guys as Michael Hodges, and he's one of the members of the Forgotten Few. Now, the other guy was ID'd as Michael Sick Mike Stevenson, and he's the guy who Hell's Angels were like, no, thank you, sir. We don't want any of your stuff over here. So we meet Sergeant Jeff Wiemet, who says that Michael Stevenson is one of the most violent people he's ever investigated. And a look into his past shows a whole lot of methamphetamine charges. So the police didn't have enough evidence to bring in the two Mikes, Michael Hodges and Michael Stevenson. So they just start kind of questioning everybody in the Mikes' world. And no one was willing to rat the guy out. So the police, once they realized that Michael Stevenson was involved, told Rose, like, you got to expect the worst because these guys are violent.
Yeah, I don't know if this they give a timeline at this point as to how much time has passed since his disappearance.
Mm-mm, but I mean, it's at least 48 hours if the police are investigating now.
Well, no, it could be. It would if the police are involved. It's longer. It's more.
That's
than
what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. You said
at least 48
but,
hours. Yeah.
Oh yeah. What am I talking about? All right. So, but I'm just saying it's kind of like all right. So we're. They're reporting you have to expect the worst because the people who are involved are clearly the kind of people who would do terrible things. You pointed out that the reenactment kind of gave you a little chuckle because he kind of goes to the door, screen door, and he's kind of the officers or the detective is questioning him. And he says, well, you know, arrest me or get the heck out of here.
Get the heck out of here. And he says it's so quiet and calm, but we're supposed to be so scared of this guy. But they are a scary, scary gang. And Rose is like, I need answers to what happened for my son. So what does she do? She grabs her little gal pal, Carol Jensen. They tart themselves up and they go undercover to go infiltrate this gang.
They tease the hair, everything.
They tease the hair. She's like, I wore tight pants. I had my hair wild. And like, it was amazing. So they're going to all these like rough and tumble clubs. And she's like, I wanted to make sure everyone knew my gun was loaded. And they go around and they just start looking for Michael Stevenson. And keep in mind, this is like the most violent guy this detective's ever seen. So she said that they spent hundreds of hours going to, quote, low-class establishments trying to solicit information from informants. And she, like, had a picture of her son. She's like, this is my son. What happened to him? She's getting a little bit of info. She follows up every single lead that she is given, canvasses the neighborhood, and kept the cops informed because she is so cool.
I don't know. I kept thinking like she's going to be dead. You know, she's not dead at this point. I think she's in the discussion at this point, but we're expecting something bad to happen because this type of scenario just never really ends positive.
No. Yeah. And these are not the kind of people that are cool with you, like going undercover and gaining their secrets. And so, and they are so scary. So she hires a private investigator. This private investigator sets up a meeting with a woman who says, I know what happened to your son. So they had to meet in a dark motorhome because the witness didn't want to be identified. And how fearless is this mom going and meeting this random informant? It could be somebody to kill her.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it kind of feels like that's what's going to happen in the near future, too, with what else we learn.
Definitely. And she's like, you know, the informant who is publicly later identified. So I think we can give her info as one of the suspect's ex-wives. Mm-hmm. So she says, like, I know what happened to your son. He was tortured for 3 to 5 days and then he was killed. And Rose is like, please go to the police with this information. I need justice for my son. I'll pay you to go to the police. Like, please go. And she's like, I can't. I'm too scared. Michael Stevenson's going to kill me. He's crazy.
We never get a motive for this, which I just think is probably the most disturbing aspect of this. I don't think there's a public motive anyway, aside from maybe they just wanted to steal this Harley and he got loud and they thought, if you want to get loud, we're in the mood, we're wasted, it's July 4th, you know?
Yeah. And I think the motive is just that they were methed out of their minds. Like, meth makes you do some messed up stuff.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, of course, it's exactly the kind of people who would have been in that situation. They have a location for it. They have people who are going to help them do it. It's just a very, very tragic story. When a lot of the stories didn't kind of pan out for Rose, right?
Mm-hmm.
She went to the world of psychics, which I think can be kind of a scary way to go down. I feel as though personally psychics and palmists and tea leaf readers, they can, I do have a belief in the kind of help that they can bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're looking for such specific, important information, I think you need more than hints. You need yeah. more. You need real answers.
And it just goes to show you how desperate she was to get answers. Yeah. But you found some information that showed that just whenever something like this happens, it seems like the worst kind of people come out of the woodwork. And people were kind of stringing her along for money to say, oh, your son's still alive. If you give me $500. Oh, well, now $5,000.
And she's telling everybody, too. I mean, she's basically putting herself out there to be victimized. She has people working in her house in 1981. And she's probably telling the whole story. A few days later, the 18-year-old son of one of the repairmen give her a call. She doesn't know that's who he is and says that if you pay me $500, I'll give you information about your son. Or you know, basically lead to either where he is. I couldn't find exactly the information that he was offering for $500. He even patted her on the back and said, how does it feel to know your son is still alive? So I guess that was the information. Where is he alive?
Scumbag.
3 years later, I would have a very tough time believing he was still alive.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. But she's desperate to hold on to something.
He then ups the ransom to $5,000. She says, I need to hear my son's voice, which, all right, you now threw out $500 and now you want to hear the voice. The desperation, it's just really sad. And as a parent, I guess maybe I would do anything I can. It's just you have to have some level of scruples. And what's so sad about the entire thing is that, you know, they didn't know what to do. And then it turned to, well, if you don't give me the $5,000, your daughter's going to be kidnapped. I know what she looks like. And things start getting really personal with the people that you're in front of. They turn to the police. They set up a sting operation. And this schmuck, who probably had absolutely nothing to do with this in the first place, is busted and probably ruined his life forever.
Yeah. And, you know, the police have a theory that Michael, you know, the Mikes kind of forced Gus into Michael Stevenson's house and forced him into the garage. Now, on June 19th, 1986, Michael Stevenson, the sick Mike guy, he was killed during a failed extortion attempt. He had a long rap sheet about for like kidnapping young women and drugging them and holding them hostage and raping them. And in 1986, he was shot by a quote elderly victim and killed. Good. So I'm sorry to say, but RIP SOB. I don't care. You're an evil person.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't shed a tear for somebody who is really ruined the lives of so many people.
Exactly. But, you know, now that he's dead, a lot more witnesses are willing to come forward because they all thought Sick Mike was going to kill him. Mm-hmm. So we learned that, quote, there were certain acts of violence against Gus Hoffman, which happened in the garage and ultimately led to his death. We don't get details, but you and I, unfortunately, did dig up some details.
Yeah, the LA Times really brought out a lot of information this time around.
Yeah.
Essentially, tortured a number of different ways, including sexually. And they even think that there was a girl there taking pictures. And basically, they wanted to abuse and torture while humiliating.
Now, can I just say this isn't stated anywhere, but I personally think that maybe that girl was the ex-wife who came forward.
Yeah.
Because she seemed to know a lot of details.
Yeah, but, you know, I can see that. There was supposed to be a girl, you know, it's.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, it's so sad. But, you know, I hope it's not a true story, but we do get three men arrested. Michael Hodges, a guy named Richard Dollar, and John Stell. And they were convicted of sodomy and murder. So poor Gus. Apparently, that was the kind of sexual torture he was under for 3 to 5 days. And then the four of them, including Mike Stevenson, all kicked him to death.
Now, this is what I'm not sure. That's just terrible. That's the
problem. Isn't it?
How, without the body, how do we determine any of this, really? It's all hearsay. It's all word of mouth. It's all
Unless that girl did take the pictures.
Somebody had to have testified. Right.
Yeah, but what if she had the pictures?
That's true. I mean, there's a lot of information. Of course, we're not privy to actual evidence that may exist within this case.
Yeah,
but if they're being convicted of murder and sentenced to life, I'm going to guess those pictures exist in real life.
Poor Gus. I mean, what did he even ever do to anybody?
Right. I mean, he just bought a really stupid motorcycle and spent way too much money to restore it.
Yeah. And sadly, there's never been any trace of Gus Hoffman found. And Rose is like, I just want to bury my son. I want my son to have some dignity. And she begs Unsolved Mysteries, like, to tell her, the viewers, to tell her if they know anything about where her son is. Like, let her know.
I can only imagine how many people have reached out to her and tried to scam her, or effectively scammed her. I wish it was a fictional movie, of course, but I think that it would make for such a very it's such an amazing topic, and Rose has balls of steel for doing what she did.
I love Rose so much. Mm-hmm. What a mother will do. Oh my God. But I do want to just wrap this up. Hodges and Stell both died behind bars. Based on testimony of witnesses, investigators believe that Gus's body was dismembered in Michael Stevenson's garage and taken to an unknown location. And they believe that the bike was sold to a chop shop just to kind of unload it when they realized, oh, everybody's looking for this guy. So as of the time of this recording, Rose, the little baddie that she is still alive and kicking at 85 years old. And Richard Dollar, one of the guys, the only surviving member of this attack, is still serving time in California.
You mean Dick Dollar?
Yep, exactly.
I would definitely go by Dick Dollar if I was him. But so we'll move on to the next story. It's a tough one because some of these are just like, I think I'm going to remember that story from time to time. You know, like it's one of those really kind of chilling tales. But so this is called Ready Teller Robbery.
And this is an update. So as per usual, we're just going to breeze kind of through it because the other story is actually featured in full on season one, episode 12. So when we cover that episode, we'll cover everything.
Yeah. So this is somebody who went to an ATM and they feel as though that somebody saw him put in his ATM code. I wasn't really following the story great. So if you want
to. I got you. So June 8th, 1988, we have 22-year-old Matthew Chase goes to an ATM and he is never seen from again. So the police pull the ATM footage and they see a guy standing like right where your elbow would be when you're standing by an ATM. And they can kind of make out the guy's face a little bit. So they're like, nobody would willingly let a stranger stand that close to them at the ATM, implying maybe he had like a gun to his back or something like that, that would allow this guy to stand so close. So nobody can find Matthew, and the police think that Matthew was abducted by this guy. So they spend months searching for him in Los Angeles. And in September 17th of 1988, the remains of Matthew are found in a ravine in Pasadena. Now, all the way later in March of 1989, the LA coroner positively IDs the remains as belonging to Matthew Chase. So this is Matthew. And ATM guy is a main suspect. So the image is horrible. And we get like an artist rendering based off the ATM footage of what the guy would look like. And nobody can ID him. Nobody can ID him. So we also learn that his 1983 red Volkswagen GTI was also stolen and that the killer may have been seen driving it. Now, the car got recovered. And in there was a blue bandana that's thought to belong to his killer. And the bandana has the letters ES, PBS, CL on it, which leads some to believe that the suspect is a member of the gang Eastside Playboys and the Chicos Locos set.
Yeah, I bet you they had like five of them made or something.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Like, the car was completely wiped down of prints. There was nothing leading this guy. And then you're going to leave your bandana? Like, that seems really slow.
Or it could be kind of a plant from another gang. You know, almost seems like that a little bit.
I totally agree. It's so sloppy. So I just want to say there's this guy. We'll get to the update, but there's this guy on Facebook. His name is Michael W. I'm not going to give out his information without his permission. He was like instrumental, in my opinion, of keeping this case in the spotlight. He would call the police all the time, be like, where are the leads going with this? Where's this? He made a, you know, Justice for Matthew Chase group. And it was discovered all the way in February of 2018 that the police have announced that they've closed this case.
Wow.
They believe that the killer was a gang member named David Bear Meza. And he just so happened to die within 48 hours of Matthew's disappearance, which, you know, is so frustrating. His family will never get justice. But they brought in his girlfriend at the time, Meza's girlfriend at the time, and she ID'd him as the man in the pictures during a police interview. And apparently what the guy Michael W. thinks, and this is just his thing on Facebook, is that he went rogue with this killing and or it was so sloppy that he was killed in retaliation.
I feel like that is something that is a solution of a lot of different stories. Like somebody just like, I'll do it on my own. And then you screw up. You don't have the kind of backup that you normally would. And they need to put you down in the way.
Yeah. So that was that story. But it just goes to show you some armchair detectives really get stuff done.
Yeah. And I do want to just make fun of the surveillance footage because in 1985, we have this picture, right? And it looks just terrible. And I kind of just, I went on YouTube and I looked for some current footage. And I found this picture, and this could be you. If you put on a red hat, I think this could be you.
Oh, my God. I've never been more insulted in my life.
Well, I mean, it's like you, I think you can barely tell that this is a female. I think this could be almost anybody, right? Mm-hmm. Don't be insulted.
I know. I'm just
you insult easy.
You.
So I'm just kidding. No, but do you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, this could be anyone. This is just, the footage is terrible. And that's from 2020. So 35 years apart, just as blurry as ever. Upgrade to 4K. That's all. It's
exactly. I know. I mean, could it be that expensive? Like, I'd want my ATM to have really good footage, but what can you do?
I want to be able to watch it too.
Yeah, totally. Oh, my God.
Do you like selfies? Like, you got $40. No, so this brings us to a story that is very important to Long Island, and I'll be insulted if you say anything negative about Charles Lindbergh. I'm just kidding, of course.
Well, I'm no promises, but yeah, we are doing a lot of this information I found from an amazing article called The Mysterious Disappointment of the Loso Blanc by Evan Andrews.
Disappointment? You said disappointment. Disappearance.
Did I?
Yes. It's hilarious.
Oh my God. That was Freudian because I knew I was going to insult Charles Lindbergh to you. So basically, it's May 21st, 1927, and Charles, you know, Lucky Lindy Lindbergh was the first person to fly nonstop across the Atlantic from New York to Paris. He's actually not the first person to fly across the Atlantic. There was two people, John Alcock and Arthur Brown, who
let me just write down this time so I can edit this part out. I'm just kidding. Go on.
They made a nonstop transatlantic flight from Newfoundland to Ireland that same year. So actually, 8 years earlier. In 1919, there is a French-American hotel mogul named Raymond Ortig, and he offers a $25,000.
Crazy.
In 2020 money, that is like $375,000 reward to the first aviator who makes a nonstop flight between New York and Paris.
Now, I know it was a big deal at the time, too, because, I mean, this is all post-World War One. Mm-hmm. This is... You know, the whole Industrial Revolution is going crazy and there's money everywhere at this period of time.
Yeah, but those guys were like, oh, we got this. So they did that Newfoundland to Ireland one. And the guy was like, oh, you're not going to get the money because I said New York to
But in all fairness, there's 1,600 miles difference between those two destinations.
But I've always thought Charles Lindbergh's the first person to fly nonstop across the Atlantic. And it just turns out that's not true.
It's true enough. Let's leave it at that. No, so, there's a Max. Like there's an Apple store, I think, where he took off now in the Roosevelt Field Mall.
That doesn't surprise me. But yeah, Lucky Lindy was given a hero's welcome when he returned home. Now, 10 days earlier, French pilots Charles Nungesser and Francois Colli were trying to beat Lindbergh in the feat because $25,000. So they have an open cockpit biplane called the Loso Blanc or the White Bird.
This guy's a badass. I mean, he's got the patch. Cool. I really, when I saw the pictures of them, I don't usually side with the French, but I love their dressing. But for the most part, no, I'm just kidding, of course. But this guy just seems so cool to me. And I could just see like the cigarette with the holder. And I look him up and I find a picture of him with the cigarette with the holder. So
yeah, no, he is a classy gentleman. He is so cool. And they're actually both kind of celebrities. Mm-hmm. They're both World War One veterans. Nungesser is actually the most decorated French World War One veteran. And he was also a Hollywood stunt pilot.
Now,
Colli was the first guy who actually traveled across the Mediterranean. So he and his partner, Paul Tarascon, were supposed to do this trip, but Tarascon got injured at the last minute and had to drop out. So he was replaced with Nungesser.
It's always weird. Like, even with the Amelia Earhart, before she was supposed to leave, her co-pilot had to be switched out. And it was like with some, like, alcoholic guy.
Conspiracy.
Yeah, well, you know, of course it's conspiracies, but can you imagine going across the Atlantic in these things? I mean, I think when Charles Lindbergh did it for the very first time, when he went on his embarkment, I think we had like 400 something gallons of gas. I mean, that's all that's there. It's just noise.
I mean, they had an open cockpit biplane. That is so crazy. And they actually, it's really cool. So Nungesser and Cole Lee actually had this plane specifically made. It would drop its landing gear as soon as they didn't need it anymore, as soon as they took off, just to lessen the weight. And then it was like watertight. So they were supposed to land at the base of the Statue of Liberty.
How cool would that be? I mean, in all seriousness.
No, it's a big deal. Thousands of people that turn out on the Statue of Liberty because they're like, Nungesser and Cole Lee, they're going to do it.
And it's French and French, too, because, you know, the statue came from France. And exactly. It's just a total really crazy thing. Sorry.
No, that's exactly. And it's so perfect. So they have thousands of people turn up and nobody shows up. You know, where are Nungesser and Cole Lee? So they actually immediately sent out like search and rescue people, everything, when they realized like, I don't think these guys are going to make it. So apparently Lindbergh was supposed to take his flight this week, but there was really bad weather over the Atlantic. So the French pilots are like, this could be our chance to beat Lindbergh, not only to the money, but, you know, to this huge feat. I mean, this is a big deal.
And it was a big deal at the time. I mean, it was thought to be like one of those things where it was impossible.
Yeah, exactly. So the L'Oiseau Blanc was last seen actually by spectators over Ireland at 10:30 a.m.
I don't buy it just because Ireland is so north, but it's possible they took a different route. I mean, a wind could probably blow that thing 500 miles off course.
So. It's so crazy.
And maybe that's why they ended up elsewhere. It's very possible, too.
So, you know, a lot of people think it crashed at sea and you're like, what does this have to do with Unsolved Mysteries? Well, we realize in 1971, this hunter, Jim Reed, is like deep in the woods of Maine and he discovers a, quote, strange moss covered mound. And he thought it was a boulder. So he's like, let me poke it with a stick. And he does. And he sees that it's an aircraft engine and he knows it's an aircraft engine because he was like some kind of mechanic or something. So he,
which I don't buy either. I have a very tough time with this guy's story because an aircraft engine from 1919 is not going to look like an aircraft engine today. It's going to look more like a Volkswagen Beetle engine.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So, it's just like 1927 to 1971. There's a huge amount of.
Sorry to be such a doubting Thomas, but I have a tough time with that.
Well, another thing to add to the kind of BS of his story is that he was never able to relocate the engine.
Yeah.
So we're like, if it's from the White Bird, could this be proof that Lucky Lindy was not the first person to fly across the Atlantic, which we already know he's not the first person to fly across the Atlantic.
This reminds me of the story we did a few episodes ago with the looking for water underground and never being able to find the source of fresh water. I think Nevada, but I just feel like it would have come out by now. We would be able to locate this with today's technology.
Yeah. So we get to meet these kind of cool husband and wife aviation archaeologist team, Rick Gillespie and Pat Thrasher.
Rick's pretty intense.
Yes. And he still is intense. He's still doing his thing. Yeah. So they've given up their jobs to dedicate their lives to finding out what happened to the White Bird. So we learned that most of the aircraft was made out of this wooden cloth, which would have disintegrated by now. So there's no use even looking for that.
Yeah.
Now, I did find something that in 1927, there were reports of white plane wreckage washing up in New York.
I would just imagine that plane wreckage by 1927, not overly common, but not totally uncommon, especially in New York. I mean, I think in 1927, we already had Floyd Bennett Field built here. So, I mean, it's Floyd Bennett Field is like in Brooklyn, right on the water. And I have to look into that. But I'm pretty sure it was already active at this point. I would just imagine that planes were constantly crashing.
I agree with you as far as, like you said, especially in New York. But we have a lot of people who say that when Coley and Nungesser were making this trip that they're in like rural Maine, and that they heard an airplane, and they know they heard an airplane because they were like, what is this thing? I've never seen this before. Like, what? It's the first airplane they've ever seen.
Oh, sure. And I'm sure it's loud as hell.
Oh my God. Yeah, I can imagine. And so there's like a, there's like 15 people in Maine that are willing to co-sign that they saw this guy, this plane fly over Maine. Now that is the story of the white bird. Rick and Pat focus on like these old people from Maine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting about Rick. Rick is, he discovered this information about Amelia Earhart that is called like the Taiga Research Company, about like flights, whatever. I don't know. And
there's so many weird roads you can go down with Amelia Earhart, though.
Yeah, but he, remember that like windshield was found on the island, and there was like small fires and bones and stuff like that. I guess he was the one to discover that.
Okay.
And so his theory is that her and her little drunky drunk co-pilot landed and tried to be castaways and then ultimately died by like starvation, dehydration, exposure to elements, whatever.
I could have sworn there's even a photograph floating around somewhere. I have to look for that, of somebody who could easily be her with some natives of some sort.
Oh,
that could be fake. I have to look.
Yeah. I've never heard about that, but so he has a book called Finding Amelia that actually is pretty recent and you could still find on Amazon. There's several people, not only in Maine, but also in Nova Scotia, who say that they heard the plane earlier that day. And so Pat Thresher and Rick go out in an airplane, man, and they find a bunch of these unusual pieces of wood that they think are from Europe. And when put them all together, they measure 2 meters or 6 feet long. And that's how long the wingspan of the plane would have been. So they kind of think they found it. Now, it's worth noting that as of 2020, Gillespie has changed his theory of what he thinks happens. He thinks that the plane crashed in Newfoundland because he found a piece of metal in a pond in Newfoundland that matched the color of the plane, but it could not be positively ID'd.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we're talking literally 100 years later, and we're talking about, you know, these things are created to be lightweight and kind of probably overly flammable.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that any of these theories are silly. It's just I think that it would take a lot more evidence to convince me, like if they found that engine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That would be really amazing.
And they even like went up in an airplane and were trying to like echolocate it, basically, and they couldn't find it. So I'm not sure whatever happened to that.
Imagine that conversation. You're up there, maybe in a helicopter or something. Like, no, it's right about there.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you sure? Oh, maybe over there.
Exactly. And they're fighting. They're bickering because they're husband and wife.
And the guy says over and over again, it was a mound. You know, it's like,
it's
all
just
right,
like a boulder covered in moss. It's like, well, we're in the wilderness, so.
Yeah. Well, you know what? If it's out there, eventually it'll show. Or not. You know, it's, I just feel like it's metal and we would be able to kind of locate that on some level. But
I will say Nungesser and Coley, badass dudes, love them. There is a airfield where Lindy landed that Coley and Nungesser departed from, and there's a monument that still stands today that says, quote, in honor of those who tried and of the one who succeeded.
Yeah, well, there's a plaque in Roosevelt Field near the Apple Store where if you take a picture of it, you can actually see Cardi B in the background.
Oh my God.
No, well, it's just a cutout of her from like the Gap or something like that. You know, they're advertising. But that's the way we put tributes out there for people on Long Island. No, but we actually do have an aviation museum around where I had something to do with his planes and everything. And I think they might even have one of his originals. So, but anyway, you know, we do have a lot of respect. But yeah, it's a very controversial thing with Lindbergh. And of course, Lindbergh would, if you have an interest in this type of thing, of course, look into the Lindbergh baby, you know, which becomes a whole other rabbit hole and topic that's fascinating to read about.
I was shocked that there wasn't a Lindbergh baby Unsolved Mysteries. I looked for it today. It's
really?
Not a thing.
That is shocking.
It's so right up its alley, right?
By the way, today you can fly to Paris, probably on a 747, for a little over $400 one way.
Oh, road trip.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably still smoke inside. It's no one these days. But so this brings us to a very, very scary and violent poison death.
Oof. Yeah, and almost all of this information came from D Magazine, which I think is like Dallas Magazine. It's called The Wax Museum Murder Mystery by Glenna Whitley. It was actually written in 1989. It's so thorough.
Yeah.
So October 1989, we're in Texas, Arlington, Texas. And it is like the funeral of 43-year-old Patsy Bolton Wright. She died very suddenly. And we have her daughter, Leslie, talking to Unsolved Mysteries about losing her mom.
Yeah, it's kind of, she seems like she's really still emotional. I mean, of course, she's still emotional about it. But
yeah.
I think, you know, the camera's there and she might even be caught up in the moment of being just dealing with this, what she had to deal with again in front
and
of the cameras.
And this is still when Unsolved Mysteries was like, we want you to reenact it for us. So she has to go reshoot a bunch of scenes of like inside her mom's funeral and everybody hugging her. So I'm sure it's a very emotional experience. We also get to meet Sister Sally Horning. Now, 8 days after the memorial service, Unsolved Mysteries incorrectly says that's when the autopsy was performed, but that's not true. 8 days is way too long. It's actually when the autopsy specimens were tested. So they put blood into a mass spectrometer, also known as a gas chromatograph, if you watch Forensic Files.
You know, it's like a big computer with a lot of lights.
Exactly. And it checks for 56,000 different foreign substances in
that
her
blood
samples.
That blew me away. That,
yeah.
The fact that that technology existed, yeah. At the same time, we have ATM footage that looks like it was shot on duct tape, you know, so
yeah,
it's a strange world where some things are so advanced and other things are just not. But 56,000 different foreign substances are tested, and that blew me away.
It was a crazy amount, but I have to tell you, we are dealing with some old money in Texas. Like, I don't doubt that they're going to have some better technology.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yes.
So it shows a huge spike in the poison strychnine. Robert Stack tells us that this is a very cruel way to die. And one of the most disturbing things I've ever researched is, how do you die through strychnine poisoning?
This scared me a little bit. You told me about this about a week ago when you lost internet. And I was like, I hope she's okay.
sweet.
No, but you told me about it and I was like, that it really stuck with me a little bit, you know.
Yeah, oh, me too.
So
this
please,
is like,
please tell me what you told
film.
Me.
So I'm going to. This is within 15 minutes of ingestion, victims experience severe muscular twitching, which is followed by a sensation of suffocation and a sudden onset of massive convulsions. The head and feet are bent backwards in tectonic spasms. The face turns blue and the mouth contracts into a fixed grin. And you ultimately die because your respiratory muscles are completely paralyzed.
The fixed grin just kind of, that's the thing that where it's like, it's
I was
the
like,
slap
is the,
in the face. Literally.
I was like, is the Riddler here? Like, this is something that seems like it's out of a comic book or out of like a movie or something. It's so crazy.
Yeah, it just seems, and it does. It doesn't seem to be a very, and it goes away and then comes back with like contractions.
So creepy. So it's 3 a.m. on the morning of Patsy's death, and her sister and brother-in-law, her brother-in-law's name's Steve, they were awakened by a frantic phone call by Patsy.
Probably now, during, you know, the spasm probably subsided briefly and she picks up the phone and then it just happens again. You know, it's crazy. That is so
scary. That's the only thing I can imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so on the call, Patsy says, I've taken some NyQuil and something is really, really wrong. Now, they weren't able to call, they tried to call an ambulance. But the thing is that Patsy was just in the middle of buying this 30-acre, like, sprawling, beautiful Texas
estate.
She had money.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. These people both, I mean, all these people come from so much money.
Let me ask you, did they say NyQuil, the brand? I don't think they did, right?
Not on Unsolved Mysteries, but in the article I read, it was NyQuil. So she is actually renting a house while the paperwork goes through until her, like, brand new 30-acre
mansion. Her sprawling, opulent, beautiful place is done.
Exactly. So Sally, the sister, calls the police, and the police are like, where do you need the ambulance sent? She's like, I don't know, because she doesn't know her sister's temporary housing address. So Sally and Steve are like, we got to go. They run over. They try to get in. And Sally would later recall that where Patsy had earlier told her that she kept a spare key was empty. The key was gone. So Steve hops in a window, sees Patsy on her bed, and he kind of runs down the stairs, lets Sally in. And they can't wake Patsy up. So they call 911, give her CPR, and Steve says that when they're doing the compressions, that a lot of green substance came out of Patsy's mouth and that they had to continually spit it out of their own mouths while giving her mouth to mouth.
Now, this is one of those things where I thought, because they come up as possible people being involved with the poisoning. And mm-hmm. I was thinking, I don't believe that there's any way that this person would be doing this physically if he would not be administering mouth-to-mouth CPR, taking that risk of poisoning. On the other hand, who saw him do it?
Exactly. Exactly. It's him telling us that he gave mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Yeah. So who's saying that? Also, well, okay, so I'm sorry, we'll get to that.
Because it's also a decent way to dismiss yourself from the case.
And say, you know, maybe that's why I have strychnine on me, maybe.
If I'm wrong, I'm sorry. It's just, you know, it's a terrible thing to say of the person. But yeah, I mean, it would be, you know, you just need this one other person to basically back up your story.
I hear you too. It's wrong. It's what we do almost all the time of saying, is it possible this guy could have done it? No disrespect. We're just thinking out loud. We're not saying anybody, but we're thinking out loud. But now, let me tell you this, okay, just while we're on this topic. Hypothetically speaking, fan fiction, whatever you want to say, allegedly. What if he held her down and poured it in her mouth? And then that's why it was all over her mouth and all over the bed. And he said it was all over the bed because I had to spit it out when I was giving her mouth to mouth.
Huh. Do you think they would have to, though? I mean, I feel like that's possible, though.
I'm just trying to think outside the box, trying to solve this mystery. Yeah. But the EMTs arrive and they take her to the hospital. And sadly, Patsy dies along the way. And this woman is like, she looks like a beauty pageant contestant. She looks Texas. She's got the like most beautiful smile. Mm-hmm. We'll post a picture of her, of course, on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind podcast. But because she mentioned to Sally and Steve on the phone call that she took cold medicine, the police take the NyQuil and bag it up for evidence. So when they test the cold medicine, it has crazy amounts of strychnine in it.
Now, I have not been able to find a source for strychnine, which, of course, scares me because I now have that in my search history. But
I know, me too.
But thankfully, this podcast will, you know, make me innocent. So
I hope
Yeah, right. I know that if you want to, you can synthesize it yourself. Like you can actually create it yourself. It's a natural substance, but you would need to have some type of a chemical background. That's where we start looking at other people who are involved in the background, but I'm sure you'll get to that. But there was a ton of strychnine in there. It really doesn't take that much to kill you.
And I just want to say, our cover our ass disclaimer, just because you can doesn't mean you should, if you're thinking about it out there.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to say you shouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So the FBI have ruled out product tampering because that was like a big panic with the Tylenol poisons and stuff like that. They're like, this was only one incident. So
and I think that was cyanide. But yeah, I mean, I think of it as cyanide, I think, is like a quick death.
Yeah, no, and it was cyanide. I'm just saying, there was a product tampering fever pitch, going on. So they say, here's the reasons why she wouldn't kill herself. One, oh my God, what a horrible way to die. But we know that sometimes people do. Her alarm went off the next morning, which indicates that she meant to wake up. You know, she has two kids. She owns a successful $6 million wax museum called the Great Southwest Wax Museum.
They said there were two, and I couldn't find more than one.
There is two. I don't remember the details because I did look this up a few days ago. There is two for sure. It's like inherited by their dad.
I don't think they exist anymore, though.
Oh, no. Not anymore. I mean, it's a wax museum. Like, who cares? But
I care. No, I'm kidding. Okay. Madame Tussaud, you know.
I know. No, I hate got the market cornered.
But, I hate wax museum, personally. They never look right, personally.
Yeah. And just, ugh. But anyway, she had recently purchased some horses, and one of the horses was $26,000 in 1987. And, you know, lest we forget, she was also in the middle of purchasing that huge ranch.
Yeah, she had money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So they test the strychnine in the bottle of NyQuil, and they realize that it was enough to kill 8 to 9 people. And they think it's someone close to her because A, her burglar alarm wasn't set that night, and B, only those close to Patsy knew that when she was having trouble sleeping, she would take some NyQuil because everyone knows that knocks you out.
Yeah. I'll look forward to it when I have a cold.
Yo, same. Oh my God, you're in like a NyQuil coma. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So first things first, we're looking at Sally and Steve, the sister and her husband, because you always want to look at the person who was last seen with them, who discovered the body. Now, the reasons why they're suspects, you know, Sally only has to gain by her business partner, her sister, being gone. They were the last ones to see her. They had a reason for their prints and maybe traces of strychnine to be there. Steve says, oh, Patsy, I loved my sister-in-law. Like, we got along fine. But Patsy called Steve plastic and, quote, a phony, and said on the day before her death, quote, I don't want Steve horning anywhere around me. Steve had allegedly squandered Sally, his wife's inheritance, and they were both pretty broke. And in fact, they were both arrested on a couple counts of passing bad checks back in 1970.
But at the same time, this is her first call, right?
Right, exactly. If you believe that story.
Yeah, that's where it gets like kind of strange. Like, you know, it's like, well, you're going through these spasms, yet, these are the first people you're reaching out to.
I know. Oh, my gosh.
Like, and these are the people you can trust, but you're saying, you know, crap about them like that. I know.
But, you know, I'm sure you're panicking. I mean, you don't know what the heck is going on with you. One would think that her first call would be to 911, where she knows her address, you know, but I don't know. She probably didn't think, like, I'm dying. She was just like, I need help.
That's a good point. I would imagine this is very, very violent, especially by the description that you read before.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, do you risk that fear of getting on 911 and them saying, like, you know, please hold, you know?
Yeah, it's possible.
Reach out to somebody who can, I guess, help? Like, you know, they know who you are and they know all of those type of details, and you don't have to do much more than say, I need help.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably what she was thinking of. Something very peculiar, though, is that the sisters each had $500,000 in life insurance taken out on the other one. And that was scheduled to be changed just 2 weeks before Patsy died, was when Sally and therefore Steve, her husband, were taken off as Patsy's beneficiary. Now, Steve, we learn, also has a bit of a history of violence against women. He was arrested in the 70s for assaulting a woman, although the charges were later dropped. So Steve and Sally and her and Patsy's kids come in voluntarily to take polygraph tests, and they pass. Now, Steve's first test was inconclusive, but he passed the second one. Yeah, it's just interesting. So they interview, you know, her current boyfriend. They test former boyfriend Leo Fikes. Now, they wanted to talk to Leo Fikes because he was obsessed with her and she loved him but didn't want to marry him.
This guy gave me a little bit of the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah.
I immediately didn't want to believe him, but I thought that was a little bit unfair.
Mm-hmm.
Until you dug up some interesting information that he owned a small company, which I think is still around, might be owned by somebody else, but it's called the Fikes Chemical Company.
Yes. And jeez, on behalf of the Fikes Chemical Company, he made a purchase from the only company in Dallas that sells strychnine.
Oh, we didn't sell him any strychnine.
And the receipt shows that he didn't purchase strychnine. So, you know, but it's interesting. Now, another interesting fact about Leo Fikes is that cops started looking at him because they got a lead that he used to date a woman named Linda Donahue. Now, Linda was found murdered in her bed. To be fair, she was stabbed. She wasn't poisoned, but it's all stuff we got to look at. There's these two other suspects, Bill and Bonnie. They are big time suspects. They boarded her horses, and the day after she died, they decided to cash a blank check of hers that she had given for boarding the horses, which is kind of scummy.
Now, let me say, you know, this is going to be a little bit of an outing of sexism in a lot of ways. So if a woman dates men and they keep dying, you know, they'll call her like the Black Widow, or they'll come up with something. Now, this is a guy who dated two women who both wound up dead, but we don't really have a name for him, do we?
No, just, you know, scumbag.
Charlie Chaplin, there was a film called Monsieur Verdot, where he goes around and He seduces rich older women. He murders them. It's a very dark comedy. Only a way, you know, only he could pull it off. And but it's like, even he's the dignified, you know, gentleman. And
right.
But it's, again, it's one of those kind of red flags for sexism in a lot of ways.
I hear you. You
know, we don't have, you know, because it's the same exact thing, you know.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I feel like it's sexist because they're making it almost sound like sexy, the black widow, you know, instead of being like, you're a murderer. But
yeah.
just back to Bill and Bonnie, they were her horse boarders, and she put those super expensive horses that she just bought in their name so that they would inherit the horses when she died.
When did they do that?
Oh my God, I don't. I mean, if you asked me a week ago, I would have had the answer. I'm sorry.
Oh, but no. I think you, didn't they do it the same day that she died?
They did.
They did it right before she died.
The day after she died, they cashed that blank check of hers.
Oh, okay. Well, in your notes, says it also turns out that right before she died, she put the super expensive horses in their names.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's what I was saying. Like, so it just seems kind of like all very convenient. It all seems to be leading to this.
And there's a history of strychnine use in horse medicine. So the police definitely wanted them to come in and take polygraphs. They did, and they passed. Now, we still have more suspects to get to. Her ex-husband, Robert Bob William Cox, he was also investigated because they were separated and she had to get a restraining order out against him because he would harass her and stalk her. So he, as luck would have it, also had a wax museum in this same area. And she was going to be testifying against him for a suspicious arson case. Now, in 1983, there was this fire allegedly that ripped through his wax museum. And he said that it damaged all these pieces, and he filed a $400,000 claim with his insurance company. His insurance company refused to pay out because they thought that it was like done for the money. And so he took them and sued them. And she was set to testify because she told the insurance company where he hid all the wax figures so that they weren't actually damaged in the fire.
Can I just ask a question about the wax museums? Because, so are we talking about three wax museums in the circle of friends?
Yes. Yes.
That is bizarre to me.
Yeah, no, same.
Yeah. But, and, you know, the one in, 1988, you know, their museum went on, you know, was burned down, and I'm not sure if there was arson. But what are the odds of a wax museum catching on fire? You know, that one and this one, and
it's
death,
crazy.
And the ownership, and there's so much shadiness going on.
Yeah. Who knew the wax industry was so cutthroat? Like, it's crazy. And so plentiful. But Bob had actually called her and told her, like, you need to change your story because you're getting ready to sell me down the river. So he refused to take a polygraph test about her death. And her death just so happened to occur 10 days before the trial for the arson was set to begin.
Nothing to see here.
Yeah. And, you know, he won the suit. He actually was awarded $1.3 million against there. So we get to talk to Unsolved Mysteries again. They tell us that on the night of Patsy's death, there were two empty dinner plates, like, at the foot of the bed, which meant, ooh, she must have
gentleman
had, like, a
caller.
Gentleman caller.
Yeah.
Oh, jinx.
You did say that. Wow, that's...
Yeah. So this isn't true, actually. The police and firemen say there were no dinner plates at all. The only person who says there were dinner plates is Steve, the brother-in-law, which... to police make him look even more like a suspect because it sounds like he's trying to kind of throw a red herring out there. So daughter Leslie receives a phone call the day after her mom dies. And this is so messed up. So the person on the other end's like, hey, can I talk to Patsy? And Leslie's like, I'm so sorry. Like, my mama died. And she goes, good. I wanted her dead. And hung up the
phone.
Who
the hell says this?
Okay, so it's either just a jerk, prankster, horrible person, just like we learned, you know, with Rose, that people will be jerks, or it could possibly be Kitty Cox, who was married to Bob Cox when Bob and Patsy started dating.
Kitty Cox.
I know. I love it. So I can picture her, like, having, like, a fur-lined negligee. Like, I just love her. So,
I picture her being 94 years old and this little old lady named Kitty Cox.
Oh my God, I love it. Yeah. Either way, I want to be her friend, unless she calls children of deceased women and harasses them. So
yes.
The police keep saying, like, we need to catch him. We need to catch this guy. But it is a proven fact that women are 7 times more likely to use poison as a method of execution than men are. Now, the last little weird, just food for thought here. In the 1980s, a 26-year-old woman named Lori Williams worked as a receptionist for the Great Southwest Wax Museum. That's the one that Patsy and Sally own.
Yeah.
One day, she just doubles over in pain, and she had to get taken to the hospital. So 11 days later, bam, dies. 26-year-old, otherwise healthy woman just dies. And the medical examiner says that they refused to exhume Lori's body to test for strychnine poisoning in connection with Patsy's death.
Now, why would her body not be tested in the same manner that Rose...
interesting. Put through the, like, mass spectrometer or whatever?
Yeah, like, why didn't... I'm just kind of curious if it was routine or... It's possible they wanted to determine her cause of death and they did this super duper test.
I don't know. And I'm going to just say this lady had a lot of money. Patsy did. Maybe it was more important to them to find it because, you know, these sheriffs and all these people are elected positions mm-hmm. and they rely on rich people to help them get there. And maybe
that can't be a cheap test.
No. Oh, my God. No. And it says in the 80s. I don't know how early in the 80s this was. Maybe this technology didn't exist at this time. I don't know. Mm. But a 26-year-old healthy woman doesn't usually just double over and drop dead. Now, what I found from a Facebook stalking is that Steve and Sally are still married. But since this episode came out, they both changed their last name.
Now, do we know if it's associated with the timing of the release of the episode or was it just... Because this seems to have also become a very public situation in Texas.
Yeah, I don't know when this happened, but I know that when I did like the Ben Verified to do their background check, it gave me a list of each of them of like 20 at least aliases that they went by. So I don't know. These people are a little slippery. Allegedly, but they're still together. I found Leslie's Facebook. She seems to be doing just fine. Oddly enough, you can friend Patsy Bolton Wright, our victim in this story, on Facebook. Like, somebody posthumously made a Facebook for her.
And it's funny. Well, not funny. It's interesting you mentioned Been Verified. I do just want to point out to the people who listen that, you know, we subscribe to all of these different services so that we can do these kind of deep dives and research and all of these things that a lot of people, you know, well, we have to pay for that access. So I'm just... throwing it out there that I hope that people are enjoying it.
Oh, that was a little scary.
Yeah, I didn't know where that was going, but
I think it's just such a worthy thing. Yeah, I think what Mark's saying is, you know, kick us that 5-star review because we're spending some money on this stuff.
Yeah. You know what? You want, and we're going to give you a tinfoil hat in the event of you give us a review.
Yeah, and this is not a joke. We have a bunch of them and we are just waiting for your reviews to send them out to you. But anyway, let's talk about some Nazis.
Yeah, I don't get this episode. I watched this straight through. It didn't pay so much attention. Then I rewound it. I'm like, am I watching what I think I'm watching?
No, it's weird because you picked this one out.
Yeah, you know, I will. I don't know if you pick out episodes like this, but I pick them out on paper. So mm-hmm. Missing Mariners. That's what this one is. We get a little bit of a very light history of America's involvement in World War II. We go right to the family of, in 1941, 38-year-old father of two, William Betts, was the captain of the Muscogee, mm-hmm. which was pretty famous. I've heard of this. So I don't know if there was more to this story. I need to figure out why I know about the Muscogee.
I've definitely heard the name before.
Yeah. So I think there's more to the story outside of this story. Which is just basically, it should just be called Forgiving a Nazi.
So, I swear.
Thanks for killing my dad, Mr. Nazi. So,
crazy.
No offense to the Nazis listening. So,
take offense.
You can take offense. So basically the bottom line is, on February 2nd, 1942, they were going and doing another voyage. I'm kind of, hold on.
No, I just want to say real quick. So the Muscogee transports crude oil up and down the East Coast along the Atlantic. And that is like crucial for World War II. So he goes, he kisses his wife goodbye on February 2nd, 1942. And then a few weeks later, Ellen, the wife, receives a telegram that the ship was just lost. We have no idea what happened, but basically presumed dead.
Yeah. A kid on a bicycle kind of pulls up and he's,
hey, mister.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Dad's dead.
And yeah, it's like a telegram. So unfortunately, and the woman seems very sweet still. Like, you know, she's just kind of like your military wife type of,
Yeah. A World War II military wife. Like, you know, sometimes your husband dies. What can you do? And she has like a son, George Betts, who just a year later was drafted himself to serve in World War II.
Yes. What's interesting about this is, maybe this is why I've heard of the Muskogee. Was because this wasn't really a this wasn't a military boat, like you were saying.
Right.
It was just an oil tanker. Mm-hmm. But a German submarine, U-123, and is that a type of submarine? Do you know?
The U is because it's a U-boat.
Yeah.
I think 123 is just its specific number.
Okay. But essentially, they sank the boat. And this is what kind of got strange. They took a photograph of the people who had lived from the boat. Maybe, what were there, like 9 people?
There were 7 people on this boat. But what's so weird, okay, so George goes, he serves his country, whatever. He comes back. One day in 1955, a friend at work shows him this cool new book about German submarines called Sea Wolves, which you can buy on Amazon. And in this book, that's where we learn that the Muskogee was sank by the U-123. So he drives home to his mom's house to say, like, oh, my God, I think I just learned what happened to Dad. Like, wasn't this Dad's boat?
Mm-hmm.
And they find in there that picture of 7 guys from the Muskogee on a lifeboat. And they are the only survivors of the attack. It was like a torpedo attack, the U-123 to the Muskogee. And the people on the U-123 took the picture. And they say that they just, like, handed out cigarettes and water and stuff to the guys and just sent them on their way on a lifeboat.
Which I have a hard time believing, I guess.
I do, too. It sounds like such BS.
No.
Why would you just let 7 of them go after you just torpedoed this whole thing and give them cigarettes?
I mean, you take them as prisoners of war. I mean, that's what I would think. But at least I think that's what the Americans would do.
Yeah.
They were more brutal. Is that possible? But George does not see his father on the boat. His father being the captain of the boat, more than likely went down with the boat.
Yeah,
I could not be the captain, Kim. I would not be able to be.
So there's 39 missing mariners from the SS Muskogee. And this story kind of takes a turn into who are these 7 guys that are on the lifeboat?
Yeah.
We know that they never made it to any other destination, so that they were likely lost at sea or, as you said, killed or taken as prisoners of war.
That's
or whatever.
Granted that those guys would have seen if people were taken onto the boat. It's just, I don't know. There's something about the whole story that I've never, ever, have you ever heard of anything like that? Where it's kind of,
no.
You sank a boat and it's like, hey, guys, here's some MREs and cigarettes or something.
I've never heard anything from this story before. It is so crazy.
Yeah.
So George is like, the only way that I can become close to my father, who died when I was like, 17 years old, is to study this attack. So he goes, and in the 1979, he contacts like the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and they give him a bunch of microfilm, and he learns, because they're all German war records, he sees a captain's log of the U-123, and he says it's all in German. He can't read it, but he sees that the captain is Captain Reinhard Hartigan. He commanded it.
Reinhard
Hartigan. And he sank 23 Allied ships. And this guy was personally congratulated by Hitler.
There's photographic evidence of this.
Yeah, we see it on Unsolved Mysteries.
This guy lived up until June 9th, 2018.
At 105 years old.
So, I mean, here's the thing. You know, this is where I get a little conflicted. Now, I don't know what this guy's personal beliefs are, of course. Not every Nazi is a Hitler. So it's, but at the same time, this was somebody who was a Nazi hero, had the Third Reich not collapsed. You know, this guy would have been like an admiral of some sort. So I'm really conflicted when George goes and hangs out with him and wants to hear all the whole story about how Reinhardt
Kill his dad.
Yeah. We ordered the sinking of the ship, which led to his father's underwater demise.
So George and Reinhard Hartigan become like pen pals. And they're like, okay, so I know you killed my dad. Like, no big whoop. I mean, you know, whatever. Stuff happens.
Swapping jokes.
George. Yeah, probably. And George goes like, look, the way I see it, you and I were two guys who just defended our countries. And just because we were on opposite sides, whatever, we should just be happy that we survived because a lot of our brothers have not survived, which, oh, my God, how selfless can you be? Like, that is crazy. I wouldn't do that.
You know, it's kind of like it's not Coke and Pepsi. You know, it's not like, well, you know what? Your soda's just soda and my soda's. No, this is the Third Reich. This is. Yeah, no. I don't know. I have a hard time separating the two. But I understand that, you know what? They're better people than I am, maybe. And the fact that they did get together is a meeting that realistically should not have happened. According to the math of it, it's just the fact that it did happen really kind of is a very special thing.
And Reinhardt's the guy who told us, like, oh, we sent them on their way after giving them cigarettes and water. So maybe he didn't want to say, oh, yeah, no, we killed all seven of them on Unsolved Mysteries.
Right after I took this picture, we just kind of, you know, blew them all away. It's really not. But they didn't.
Exactly.
Because didn't one of them live?
Well, no.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Forget it.
No, they definitely didn't live. But George's whole mission now, George Betts, is he's like, I'm going to identify the people on the Muskogee or like their families.
Which
and
is
let
awesome.
Them know what happened.
Yeah.
Amazing. Because I never got to know what happened to my dad until, you know, 30 years later. And I don't want other families going through the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to see him chatting with the family of 26-year-old radio operator who died on the Muskogee, Clifford Chesley. And they're all old, as I'm sure you can imagine. They're like, oh, we never knew what happened to him. And we're just happy to know that even though he's dead, like, at least we have closure.
And this is very important. I think you are in the same camp as me when I say how important it is to get these kind of reactions and have this kind of closure, especially with that generation, because those people are all gone. And we're talking, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago. I think what he did was wonderful.
And so we end up getting three of the seven lifeboatmen identified. One's Nathaniel Foster, Morgan Finucane, and Anthony Sousa. And we know for sure that these guys, the other four guys, are on the roster, you know, for the USS Muskogee. So they kind of give us a little scroll of all the guys who were on the Muskogee. So after the broadcast, 12 families of the men on the Muskogee got in contact with George, and they were able to learn the fate of their loved ones. And the good news is, I guess you want to call it good news, the other four men on the lifeboat have since been identified as Valentine Baker, Claudette Blanchett, Thomas Dunleon, and Robert Oskin. So, you know, George Betts and Reinhardt have since passed away. As we said, Reinhardt died in 2018 at the age of 105 years old.
God bless him.
I guess. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it is what it is. I'm just glad that through this story of like the ravages of war, George put his own life aside to give a sense of healing to the other people who were in his situation.
I'm just kind of curious if there's a photo somewhere of Reinhardt in his Nazi uniform that I
can find it.
And it's just we didn't see one in Unsolved Mysteries.
I'm sure. Well, we'll totally find that.
But we did see him shaking hands with Hitler.
Yeah, and what other stamp of approval do you really need?
And if you're his family, is that a picture you frame? Because it's a big deal. I mean, it's kind of like if you own a Hitler painting.
I guess.
You display it. Yeah, I mean, it'd be worth a lot of money.
And if you're his family, hop on iTunes, leave us that 5-star review.
Yeah, that's another thing to jump down the rabbit hole of is Hitler's family that exists here on Long Island.
Oh, Lord. Okay, well, that's another episode.
No, I don't think they ever covered it, but maybe we can do a mini-sode or something.
Okay.
But, so this is a pretty up-and-down show, but I will say finding the identities of these people, I think, is a very uplifting thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank goodness for that.
But Kim, thank you so much for your wonderful research that you've done for this episode. This I'm not going to say this was a cursed episode because we really stuck with it.
And you know, I'm just glad to be back.
Yeah, exactly. Back as of this morning. But thank you very much. And if you enjoy this podcast, leave us a review anywhere. Play.google.com, I think it is, or iTunes or any of Stitcher. The places. Tell a friend. More jinx. Jeez.
I know.
Yeah. But you'll hear more from us. We have a lot of stuff that we're planning for the coming months. And hopefully you're enjoying this little journey of Unsolved Mysteries Rewind.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.